Greetings. Hello. Why do I always say greetings? I don't know why that's become our greetings, but it's our greetings. Greetings, hello, and welcome to the Feminist Present, where we greet you and then talk about what I need to start over. It's been a while since we did this. Sorry. Greetings, hello, and welcome to the Feminist Present, where we use the gift of feminism to figure out what's happening right now. There it is. I am Laura Good.
And I'm Adrian Dobb.
And it's been a minute since we've done this together.
It has been a minute, yes. The Feminist Present has not been on hiatus, technically, but...
not intentionally.
Yeah, we've had trouble getting our schedules aligned. I was in Germany. I have my other podcast, which now has a Patreon, which does mean that I'm in front of this microphone a whole lot, and it does create... yeah, time conflicts, unfortunately. And Laura's been very successful and very busy, and the world's been going to shit, so like that takes up time. But what am I telling you guys that? You all know this.
Yep.
So if there's one thing that the Mad Max saga lied to us about in terms of the downfall of civilizations, how fucking lame and time-consuming it was all going to be. I thought we're all going to be like shiny and chrome on the Fury Road, but no. It also turns out our funding ran out for this podcast because, I don't know if you heard, but universities are going through a bit of a tough time right now. Not to put too fine a point on it. But in case you're alarmed, the TLDR is you're going to see more of the podcast than less. We're going to take this show out of Stanford to some extent and do this ourselves. We'll see exactly what that looks like, but we're pretty excited, but expect an announcement about that in the future. Right now, and we'll get to that, I promise, we have enough on our plates, or Laura has enough on her plate.
This is the feminist future that we're talking about. Yes,
exactly, the feminist future. We're gonna, the gift of the future. Speaking of which, the Feminist Present is brought to you by Nabisco. We didn't authorize this.
I just want everybody to know Adrian ran that by me in advance, and I approved it. I thought it was a great idea, and I still do.
I think it's lame, but it's funny.
Nabisco is going to love it. I mean, I know. The cookies are coming soon.
Well, also, Casper Mattress is probably like shitting themselves, like, oh, we should have taken their call.
I felt like such a Luddite when I had to buy a new mattress when I left my marital home, and I was like, I don't want a fucking Casper mattress. I don't want a discount code from a podcast. I want to go to a store and lay down on a bed so I can see how it feels in advance of purchasing it. And that made me feel old that I wanted that experience. But sometimes you want the sensory experience of purchasing something and not just the digital dopamine experience, is my contention.
I think that's probably true. I think if I were to buy a new mattress right now, I'd just like fire up Wirecutter. Be like, tell me what to do.
I love Wirecutter, and I often rely on that for like decision-making info, but sometimes they get so far into the weeds. They recently had a feature on the best beanbag chairs, and the beanbag chairs they were hawking were literally $1,000. And I was like, that is the antithesis of why you buy a beanbag chair. You know, like you don't buy a beanbag chair when you're looking to spend a fucking grand. Anyway, this I had moral objections to.
Yeah, speaking of which, Feminist Present is brought to you by beanbag chairs. Beanbag chairs, stop calling us.
It would actually be so great if we got sponsored by some beanbag chairs right now. Because I know. My children have been asking and asking for them. So cookies, beanbag chairs, what else do my children need? The Feminist Present is bought to you by whoever makes the granola bars that my children just eat. Whatever, that's getting ahead of myself. My tagline for some marketing things that I have in my children in my future is my children eat so much. And that's just been like the plea I've been choosing to try to get engage in my media.
Yeah, I love the idea of getting sponsored. Like, Maura and I talked about that with Sarah Marshall at some point when we talked about Anita Bryant and about the fact that like she was like an orange spokeswoman. Orange
juice
spokeswoman.
That was how she came to prominence, wasn't that?
Well, yeah, but it's like funny to like be for like it's like any specific one. It's like nope, just the concept. Like if we sell our soul, I don't want it to be some dumbass corporation. I want it to like be like steel or like rare earths or something like that, right? I don't want it to be anything specific. I want it to be like the whole general concept. Like, yeah, we're for it.
I was going to say.
They're rare.
A notably problem-free history in the United States, you know, like basic mining materials. Definitely nothing problematic attached to that. Yeah. You know,
bauxite.
Was O.J. Simpson ever an Orange Juice spokesperson?
Yes, he was. But I think he was for a specific. I think he was for this Dole one.
Probably. I mean, it would be a real missed opportunity if he wasn't. I was just thinking, apparently Orange Juice has a really rough political track record that we're assembling in this conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. it shan't grace my lips again. Here's another example of how old I am. I am too old, and I think you are too, to like drink straight citrus beverages anymore. Like,
oh yeah,
I can't. The heartburn is unbearable. We're so old.
Speaking of. No, I didn't have one for this. That'd be
damn
funny.
It, I was really...
Heartburn.
Tums.
Heartburn is brought to
Tums. We need Tums to come in as a sponsor. Oh my God. I have already given them so much of my money. This is a perfect sequence. Yeah, this is going to work out great.
I was going to flip it and say, not, you know, the feminist present brought to you by Tums, but like, Heartburn is brought to you by the feminist present.
Agita, brought to you by Adrian and Laura. It's true. It's true.
So, all joking aside, all this is a long preamble, a long wind up for the punchline that I was hoping to get to, which is
wait.
This episode of The Feminist Present is brought to you by Pitchcraft, out September 16th from 10 Speed Press, written by one Laura Good.
Yay! And thank you. I'm very excited about this. It's been one of those like fire hose times. I mean, you know what it's like to release a book. But I have to say, I feel like a way to frame this book within the frame of this podcast is to talk about how our friendship and knowing each other directly contributed to it, and really roll this tape back to the beginning of the story, which
right.
I don't think like the listeners have really heard our how we met story. I think we've alluded to it over time,
yeah.
But I don't think we've ever like gone all in and tell it. So Adrian, I have my own version of this, but how did we meet?
Am I right to think that there's a version of it in this book? Is that...
There is. That's exactly why we're talking about it. Because sometimes when people write books, they want to promote them by talking about funny
yeah.
stories of how the book came to be. The meta layers in this conversation are going to get like 7-layer dip thick. But anyway, what are your recollections? How would you tell the story of how we met?
I remember every minute of it. I don't remember where it was, but other than that, it's crystal clear to me.
Sure.
It was in Oakland. I mean, first we met over the internet.
I was going to say, that was the first time we laid eyes on each other. But how did we first encounter each other?
Yeah, on the internet, the way everyone meets these days, where you taught a class on Catapult's now defunct
teaching
writing school, which was a class you offered that was essentially this book, I think, in a way. The idea was you're trying to get published. How do you pitch? How do you get paid for it? And it was revelatory. It was a lovely group of people that I never met in person, and I don't remember much about, but I remember it had good energy. And I realized pretty early on that you were, in fact, Bay Area based. And at some point, like, did I mention the Stanford connection before, or did I mention it once we met in Oakland?
No, you mentioned it before, because I think there was a lot of like self-introducing in the class of like, hi, I'm Adrian,
yeah.
This is my job. I haven't really published any books except these three academic books that I've published. Like that was what I remember about your self-introduction. And I was like, huh? You haven't published any books except for these three books? That's a funny way to present yourself.
Well, at the same time, I feel like you then, we don't want to skip ahead too far, but when you came to Stanford to basically offer this class, including to faculty members, or to give this kind of advice, including to faculty members, I think you could see why I introduced myself this way. Because it's a very different kind of thing. I see this all the time with people who are brilliant and who have interesting things to say and who are even wonderful stylists and all that, but who would send you an email and say, hey, I sent this to Time Magazine. They never got back to me. I'm like, well, yeah, I can sort of see why. It's just a very different language game.
Yeah.
You're not saying anything wrong. But I could see if you put yourself in the shoes of an editor at that time at New Republic, at The New Yorker or whatever, they're going to look at that and be like, whew, yeah, like unless this idea is like the greatest thing I've ever seen, I think this might be biting off more than I can chew.
Yeah.
And then they're going to pass or they're going to hesitate or whatever it is. So that's why I introduced myself that way. I wasn't trying to lowball it. I was just trying to say, I recognize that this is a different thing and that in some way, some of the habits I've learned in my other writing, in my day job, probably are counterproductive.
Here. Yeah.
If not directly counterproductive, then at least don't help in any of the ways that I expect them to.
Yes. Another way that I agree with all of that, obviously, and another way I would put that is like the customs and formula, per trade publishing and academic scholarly publishing, there is quality and depth of thought implicit in both, but the professional formulas and customs of how you approach another professional in trade publishing are very different than how they are in scholarly publishing.
That's
right. So yes, as you're highlighting, you had quite a bit of publishing experience and gained more after the class, I remember, but I mean, even just like how people write emails in like the media world mm-hmm. versus the university world, like "Dear Professor Daub" or "Dear Adrian, if I may," is usually how right. you would address an email to someone else in academia. That is so weird and formal to people in media who are just like, "Hey, Laura, saw your tweet." It's just a difference in customs. This is so funny. I love hearing this from your perspective, because what I remember is I'm the teacher. I think I had about 10 students. We're all rolling into, this is 2016, 2017? I think it was 2017.
Yeah.
We're all rolling into this, what amounts to like an AOL chat room. Like there's no even like video function to this online yeah. class. It's just like typing into the void. And it was a really interesting space in which to try to read people's energies, because you just aren't getting that much information. You're just getting text. And so this guy rolls in with this self-introduction that I took to be self-deprecating, but does make a certain degree of sense with the customs that we're talking about. But I was just like, that's such a funny, it did feel like a lowballing. I was like, why does he hate himself? So does he not think his three books are good enough? But then, yeah, we ran into each other at, shout out to Moira Weigel's birthday party. That was the party in Oakland that I remember.
That's right.
And that's when you told me like more about your Stanford job. I remember that was not the first comment you had made. I think probably prior to that in online chatting, you had said something to the effect of, oh, we could really use a class like this at Stanford. And I think a notable thing about like my journey is like, I was so beaten down at that moment. Like I was so like hope and faith had disappeared from my life. And I just had sort of taken it on sight that I wasn't going to achieve any of my professional dreams. So when people said interesting things to me, like, oh, I teach at Stanford, it might be cool to have something like this there, I was just like, sure, buddy, can't wait to hear how this is going to disappoint me. And I remember having a feeling after you described yourself, I was like, how could he possibly be anything that he says he is? Like, how could there be, like, if we've both lived in the Bay Area for such a long time and we're both feminists, how do we not already know each other? Mm. So the way I was looking at you very initially was very skeptical. Like, and it wasn't because of you, it was because of me. That is much clearer in retrospect. But anyway, then what happened?
I mean, I think that in some way you were justified, because of course my main worry, like I meant what I said, that I thought that there needed to be a class like this.
Clearly.
what I don't think I understood, what I couldn't believe is that there wasn't already. I started reaching out to the dean, I started reaching out to colleagues. I kept expecting the email like, hey, Adrian, that's a great idea. We do have something like this. And I don't quite see the need for another one. I'd be like, well, shoot, I got to, yeah, send a disappointing email or text to Laura. But yeah, we only need one of them. But literally, the reactions were always the two. They were like, oh, yeah, we don't have that. And second of, I would take it, right? And I was like, all right, so we're all agreed then, right? That this is really important.
That is so fascinating, because that is such a good representation of both how I initially approached this work. Like when I first started craving information about how to pitch and publish, how to write the email to the editor that compels them to give you like a gig, I kept having the sensation of there have got to be so many people who have written about this. You know, there's got to be 10,000 resources already. And I just could not find them. I could find little bits and pieces and breadcrumbs, but I could not find a compendium of like tip to tail. This is what you should think about and how to build a platform. These are the sort of communicational behaviors you should try. And here is how this whole progress like accumulates into itself to eventually produce books. I kept thinking there would be a resource like that, and there just wasn't. So right before you and I encountered each other digitally, what I had done was bang out like a 30-page Google document that was just like, here's everything I feel like I've learned as a freelancer about pitching and publishing. And I remember having a sensation, I spent about a month banging out that 30-page-ish document. And I remember having a sensation at the time of, I don't know where this is going, but I sense that this time is not going to be wasted. Like, I sense that it will go somewhere. And if it had just become the catapult class, that would have been great. But then once you got involved and moved your hot little hands around in this whole machinery, all of a sudden Stanford was interested in this. And that still is fucking wild. But then the sensation that you just described increased ever more of people being like, oh no, I've always wanted something like this, or we don't have anything like this. So that was how the whole journey at Stanford began. Mm. And I was so pregnant too in that first class.
Right.
When I came as a guest speaker, I think I was like 6 months pregnant. And I remember that like waddling across Stanford's very large campus as a pregnant person was not easy.
No.
Not easy. But anyway, the TLDR, there's no TLDR left. We have expired on the TLDR. But I have been teaching this pitching and publishing material at Stanford in some form since 2017 and in my current job since 2019. Really all thanks to Adrian. And now it has become this book, the full title of which is Pitchcraft, The Writer's Guide to Getting Agented, Published, and Paid. And I do have to actually read that out off my own cover because I always am worried I'm going to fuck up the subtitle.
Yeah, I think every writer does, right? Writers never remember their own subtitle.
Totally. And oftentimes I think the subtitles have been encouraged by the publisher, like mine certainly mm-hmm. was, and that's fine. I get it for clarity, but I'm just always afraid I'm going to get the three elements in the wrong order. But anyway, yeah, I wrote this whole book about pitching that came out of this whole class about pitching, and it's been a fascinating journey, and the book comes out on September 16th, and this is why I've been talking about how much my children eat, is I just really hope people buy the book, because that will allow me to continue to feed them.
Yeah, I mean, so I came yesterday night. I was so excited, so I texted you, and then we ended up having lunch and mm-hmm. decided to record this. This is all super pre-planned, you guys.
Very organic.
It reads really well, the parts I've read, and it's really great so far, in as was your class, in kind of demystifying the process in the sense that it's about actual flesh and blood human beings interacting with other flesh and blood human beings. That's sort of important, I think. That was my sense in taking, that's what first brought me to your class, I think, that I understood that when I write to a university press editor, I have a certain idea of what their day looks like and how my email, my book proposal, etc., intersects with that. And part of being a professional is understanding your place in their day mm-hmm. and accommodating yourself to that way. Most congenial version of that kind of interaction. And I was very aware that obviously I'd been writing for German newspapers at the time for quite a while. And so I was aware that like a German newspaper editor's day looked very different from that of a university press editor, but I didn't know what does someone at Condé Nast do all day. And I think the way you professionalize your reader, not in a bad way, what you won't get here is like, you must never, or you should always, or you have to write it this way or use this sample, although there are some good samples in it, I thought. But what it is think of what this person's day job looks like. Mm-hmm. You're now part of that day job. Mm-hmm. Here are the things you should consider. And also, here's how you make sure that person treats you with respect and with the dignity you deserve as well. Because there's an entire part of the book that's about getting paid. And if there are some listeners out there who are still starting out in this, like, that's no joke. I got an email from a German newspaper. They're like, oh, we entered something wrong in your account information. We've never paid you. And I was like, I've been writing for 3 years. I had no idea.
You hadn't noticed that they hadn't paid you?
I mean, it's like, honestly, $300 a pop.
Sure.
It was every once in a while. And I sort of, yeah, I sort of thought something was wrong, but like, I couldn't tell. But like, but I wasn't going to be a dick about it, but that's the kind of thing. And like, obviously, like, they felt awful, but like, that is a way in which you will fit into their day, as the thing where they're like, oh shit, is that a three and not a two? Oh no, right? And you have to be prepared to then be like a bit of a pain, but not be confrontational, but be like, hey, has it possibly entered my account number incorrectly? Because I'm not getting paid, you guys.
Sorry, there's so many parts of that are so funny. I can talk about the part that relates to my book, but it's just the fact that you didn't notice for 3 years that these like payments were not coming that I'm really amused by. And I'm going to correlate that back to the way you self-introduced is like, I've only published 3 books that don't count. You know, like, I do think there's some self-deprecation happening here, says the amateur psychologist. But I wrote a whole fucking chapter on chasing checks because it is so hard. Like, it is both so hard to locate jobs that pay in the media and publishing industry, and it is so hard to get your hands on the payment that you are already contractually owed. I don't know totally why this industry is so different than others in this way, but it's really annoying. But yeah, chasing checks takes up a lot of time, and I do have some strongly worded instruction on it.
Yeah, it's great. And I don't know if you kind of delve into why it might be in the book, but it seems to me, so right, when you write for sort of the big outfits now, they often have this kind of payment system. They've clearly recognized the problem you identify. And so you are made to sign up to this weird platform. And then like it kind of comes almost automatically, right? Which is exactly that. They don't want to put that on their editors as well. These people are already juggling way too much. But that means that in some way, when you're dealing with the really hyper-professional kind of places, you can pretty much count on your money getting to you. It's the charming little outfits that are all sort of run by everyone on like energy they almost don't have from their other jobs and the other things they have to do. And then, of course, nudging those people feels so bad, right? So it is this thing where it's not like, it's not just about stand up for yourself or whatever. It is about like, no, you're part of this environment. You probably want this publication to thrive. You probably feel bad bringing it up,
well,
but you still should. And yeah. And here's how you do it.
I think that there's like a technical schema to what you're describing and also like a professionalization schema. The technical schema is like, yes, the small outfits are just scrappy people running on friendships and vibes and are probably not that organized in an accounting way. That's one issue. And the big Condé Nast have implemented like automated payment processing yeah. systems that you can count on they work if your editor actually submits your invoice. But there's usually still a human link between
yeah.
between like byline and payment. But then the professionalization schema is like, who does capitalism treat like professionals who should expect yeah. to get paid? And, yeah. you know, I can in the Bay Area, the tech people are not spending as much time chasing checks, like literal chasing of the checks of the money they're already owed, as the writers and the artists.
Yeah.
And I think that this book really proceeds from a basic contention that it is egregious that artists don't get any sort of business education, because yeah. that is how livings are made, just as much as like the beautiful artistic products are. And like, we have to treat ourselves like professionals, and we need to recognize that there is actually injustice in not being treated like professionals, and not like that there's injustice in the mechanism, not assuming that we will ever need business skills, right? Like that's just an assumption that we aren't going to get paid or shouldn't get paid. And that's yeah. fucked up. Like it's been really weird for me to be a poet publishing a business book and to feel like this weird angel of capitalism. By the way, Nabisco, please, please call us.
Oh,
we're
yeah.
ready to be angels of capitalism in certain ways that keep my children fed. But it's really weird to have an MFA in poetry and be publishing a business book. But this really has become...
There's so many granola bars to buy.
I need them all. I need them fast. I don't care how many grams of sugar they have. I just need them. Where was I going with this? Oh, angel... Hold on, Nabisco. I am not an angel of capitalism. I say in the book, I am not defending capitalism. Like, I'm not here to promote the exercise of capitalism, but I'm very much fucking here to make sure that artistic labor is valued. And professionalization is one way that artistic labor is valued. And as the bottoms are falling out of so many different industries right now, media, publishing, academia, Hollywood, film, TV, all of it, the more skills of self-advocacy, we can't solve all of the systemic problems, but the more skills of self-advocacy we can have, the better equipped we are to be versatile in the face of them.
That's beautiful.
Oh, it feels like it requires so much faith that feels shaky a lot of the time to just keep preaching that an artistic career is even possible, or like a humanistic career, or even just like an intellectual career these days, because it's been rough times. Have you heard, Adrian, that it's been kind of a tough time for the smart people?
Times are getting sticky.
I mean, the first thing I said to you today when we met up for lunch was like, oh good, you're back in the country. Did you have any yeah. trouble getting back into the country? Like, that's where we are right now.
Yeah.
And yep. thank God you didn't, but like that we're hardly out of the woods with any of it either.
There's an ethical argument here about how an artist or a writer ought to be treated. There's a social argument to be made about what it says about a society that cannot value artistic labor in quite the same way it seems to value plagiarism engines run by nerds.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But there's also the political question, right? We're seeing now what happens when people don't pay their journalists. Like,
they're fact checkers.
It's all going to get bought up by some human ball sack that runs an internet company. And... you know, made to like toe the party line because like he doesn't want his access to small nuclear reactors for his data centers to be like impeded or whatever, right? There are serious ethical problems in terms of how we treat each other. There are serious social problems that come with the position that the humanities in general are put in increasingly in the society. And then there are political problems, which just like, yeah, if people cannot make this work without selling their soul to some corporate overlord, well, shit, that's bad, right? Then you're going to end up with every publication basically being Barry Weiss's The Free Press, right?
Like, I'm sorry, I just have to go in with, speaking of corporate overlords, This episode is brought to you by Stanford University.
That's right. Well, not anymore.
Not anymore. No, but I was just thinking the Geier keeps spiraling, and it's like corporate overlords, people connecting to them in order to survive. It's not like we're people who haven't done that, you know?
Right, right. No, exactly.
It's not like we're speaking in the hypothetical. Anyway, please continue.
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. At the same time, that I think is an important distinction to make as the universities are increasingly coming under attack, that Stanford has never stepped, you know, we've made fun of university daddy for a long, 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 long time. No one's ever stepped in. No one's ever said boo.
No,
you know, it's so part, true. It's part of your job. It was part of your job to make this fairly scabrous podcast where we had more F-bombs than anything, but like it never interfered. Jeff Bezos can't say that for the Washington Post.
It's true.
Sane.
It's just hard. It gets hard to tell the corporate overlords from one another, you know?
Well, yeah, I think that once the Trump administration is done with the universities, they may well resemble what Amazon is now, right? That's what they want, right? And that's what some university presidents want too, to be quite honest. They want a university where they can fire the professor who makes the shitty podcast, like where they like interview colleagues about like Dracula and like talks about dildos all the time or whatever, right? That's the world that not few of these educational overlords also want. But so far they haven't gotten it yet. So at least we have that over the Amazons of the world.
I mean, I definitely object to calling us shitty, but now I'm just trying to remember, have we ever actually talked about dildos? Like, no. I don't know if we've talked about dildos enough, to be honest. Like, it might be time.
The Feminist Present is brought to you by dildos. Dildos. We're 16 years old.
Honestly, if we're talking about like ad partnerships, we should talk to Good Vibrations because like they would love they would love us. Call and us. They have so many dildos. They're a great place. Free shout out to Good Vibrations in their multiple Bay Area locations, which are all staffed by incredibly informative, non-judgmental people, and they have a vibrant range of products. So shout out to Good Vibrations.
Yeah, Good Vibes, if you're hearing this, give us a buzz.
Can I just tell you a very San Francisco story about Good Vibrations offers a punch card with purchase where, you know, like you get a punch for every $10 you spend or something. And I do have to say that that punch card looks exactly like the punch card for an indoor playground that I used to bring my kids to a lot. And there was once or twice that I handed over a punch card at, I forget what the place was called, Little Angels, whatever, like indoor play area, and got some looks from their stoned teen employees.
Well, why didn't you just get them to punch that?
I'm saying. I mean, it was just like, it was just such a San Francisco.
You can always buy more Playland tickets, but you can't put a price on a new vibrator.
And you know who does? Usually... Good Vibrations.
That's right.
Can I be sassy and read you the paragraph of this book that most directly involves you because it ends with my single favorite sentence in the book? Would that be okay?
Oh my God, yes, please. Let's end with that. That's
perfect. Let's end with that. Okay, so
I have not heard this, listeners. This is, I'm reacting to it. This is my unboxing.
Oh, I wish we could have Adrian reaction videos. I just had like a very intuitive like, oh, I would watch that on YouTube response. Okay.
Well, I think one of the things that might be to come is a video Feminist Present, isn't it?
If you guys have opinions on that, we are debating whether there should be a video component of this podcast. And I think that in 2025 or maybe even 2026, there probably should be. Anyway, okay. So this is a passage from the introduction to Pitchcraft, The Writer's Guide to Getting Agented, Published, and Paid. And the title of this introduction chapter is The Art of Losing is Hard as Fuck to Master. This is referring back to the online portion of the class that Adrian and I were discussing earlier. And it reads, I taught 7 online rounds of the class with Catapult and 2 with the Minneapolis-based Literary Center at The Loft. And meanwhile, one of my Catapult students, I can still only tell this story with an incredulous vocal fry, told me he was a program head at Stanford and that he wanted me to teach a version of my pitching class there. To be honest, when the student told me he was the director of the program in Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies at Stanford, it's possible that I didn't entirely believe him. Part of me was like, you mean Stanford University in Palo Alto, California? Part of me was like, okay, buddy, sure you are. In all honesty, I half suspected he was generously wording his title with the intention of making a pass at me.
What? This is in print?
Yes. Real time. Maybe.
God damn it.
Oh, this is even more fun than I thought. Okay. Maybe his job sounded like the kind of job that exists only in heaven. Maybe I didn't quite trust that I'd heard him right. Or maybe, obviously, what he was proposing sounded so wildly appealing that it became terrifying, so fresh on the heels of lacerating, faith-shaking disappointment. How could I find time to teach at Stanford when I was extremely busy failing at everything? Oh. No, that's my favorite line in the book. I mean, the book turns from there. There's a pivot. There's an upswing that you were a part of and remember. Anyway, that was really fun to read that to you.
That's a great line, but what? I mean, like...
I can keep reading that you are exonerated from the charge of hitting on me. I continue.
Because, okay. I want to be very clear that...
He was not. We say that in print, too. It continues. The student kept following up. His name is Adrian, and he is witty, brilliant, and kind. My arrogant disbelief that there existed a professional feminist in the San Francisco Bay Area whom I didn't know already was dispelled when I ran into him at a mutual friend's party about 2 weeks later. There I confirmed that not only was Professor Adrian Daub telling the unvarnished truth about his position, but also he was married and gay.
That's what it says on my business card, you know? Like,
oh, your business card is only getting better after this book.
I know. Married, gay, makes possible passes.
Well, that's the setup of the irony, is that reveals a lot about me that I was making that assumption when it was so obviously not true. And
I think this is is there a chapter in the book about like how to navigate, you know, predatory behavior? Because
it's not like I had zero information on which to base such a conclusion. No, I don't venture so much into that territory, but certainly someone should. Maybe that's for the sequel.
Yeah.
The person who I have turned to the most for information on self-protection and digital security is none other than our own Moira Donegan. Yeah. So she's really the person who should write that chapter. And shout out to Myra.
Yeah. Well, with that, stay tuned for more news from the feminist present. There's definitely something coming. We've already teased some of it. You can guess the outlines. We're thinking about taking it on YouTube. We have to figure out how to monetize some part of it. But we're thinking probably ads. So we weren't entirely kidding about the mattress thing, so we might be trying to sell you mattresses, but whatever. Like,
It's just interesting to me that you assumed that we were pivoting to YouTube for video when OnlyFans is right there, Adrian. I'm just saying.
How does that even work?
I don't know, but it would
Don't people have to have like a OnlyFans account to do that?
Probably, but they also have to have a YouTube account, Adrian.
Yeah, well, the YouTube account, it's just a Google account.
We are not actually pivoting to OnlyFans, but it would be funny if we did.
Yeah. It'd be the least subscribed OnlyFans of all time.
Anyway, we are being purposefully vague in detailing when we are going to be executing on any of these plans, because we don't know yet, frankly. Yeah. But we hope that you will stay tuned. You can buy Pitchcraft you can buy it right now, and I hope you pre-order it, because that's very important. But it is out on September 16th. And may I also remind you that Adrian and I have another, six, seven combined books out in the world? Something like that. So, you know.
Read them.
You can buy and read those, too. Our children love to eat, you know.
Yeah.
Read them and weep. Read Adrian's book about the ballad and weep. I mean, you could.
Hey, yeah, it's very moving. That having been said, Laura is going to be promoting this book up and down the land. So please follow her in her exploits.
Thank you.
She has a Substack that she's using to promote.
Adrian also has a Substack. Let me also mention, for Bay Area locals, you are all invited to the release party on Pub Day of September 16th, 7 p.m. at Green Apple Books on the Park. And it's going to be a banger. Oh, new development for that. Do you know who's going to interview me and be my moderator for that? Our friend of the pod, Ingu Kang, TV critic at The New Yorker. Have you ever heard of it? Anyway, Ingu is going to be there, being my friend and moderator.
That's great. Well, I've never met in person, so this is very exciting.
Very opportune. Yeah, that's right. It would have been pandemic times.
The other thing to plug here is that Laura, as you can tell, is very engaging, very fun talking about this book. And I think... some of y'all should maybe invite her to your university, your institution, your book club or whatever, and have her talk about this book. I've done it. It fucking rocked.
That was so sweet. I really appreciate that shout out. Adrian was a real, I don't want to use the term pioneer. He was a real pathbreaker in the realm of bringing me in to talk about this kind of stuff. But yes, I am embarking on a national tour of other colleges and universities and writing programs, and even like some really good book clubs. Like, fuck, have a good dinner club or like Zoom call. I'll show up, buy some books. So you can find all that info on my website at lauragood.com. And we are both just compulsively findable on the internet. So just find us. And we can't wait to connect with you in all of these different ways very soon.
I like the idea that, like, I brought Laura Good to campus before it was cool.
You totally did. You were the pathbreaker in this. Yes, it was. There was nothing cool about it. And look how cool we are now.
I know.
It's very exciting.
Look at us now.
The Feminist Present is a production of the Michelle R. Clayman Institute for Gender Research. The co-hosts are Adrian Daub and Laura Good. This podcast is produced by Ana de Almeida Almiral. We are especially grateful to our feminist colleagues, Allison Bell Crossley, Jennifer Portillo, Cynthia Newberry, Leah Gottlieb, Bethany J. Nichols, Jessica Lopez, Susan Krieger, Argavon Salas, and Moira Donegan.